Hey, good day, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. I always get confused. Is it OIG Files? Is it OIG Roundtable? Whenever I know I've got more than one other OIG guy, I know that it's a roundtable, even though we're more like the Brady Bunch here, but that's okay. So today, another great episode of the OIG Roundtable. I'm joined by my two former OIG colleagues and good friends and professional colleagues now, Jason Eisengrein, who is a member of the executive leadership of HHS OIG, then went on to be the director of the Western UPIC, retired from there, and is now one of our senior leaders here at Advise. Always Wade McFall, who I want to say Wade McFall because that's really how it's pronounced, but I keep getting reminded that it's McFall, but it's still going to be McFall because I'm a New Yorker and that's the way we speak. So Wade McFall was an agent with the OIG out of LA, went on to be an assistant special agent in charge, or ASAC, retired from there, went on to work on the medic contract for a bit, and is now one of our SIU leads on one of our SIU contracts. And really today, we've got a special guest who's not really a special guest in that sense, but he's a member of the Advise team. He's on one of our SIU contracts, Derek Pateri. Derek, Derek started just a few months ago with us as part of our SIU team, doing investigations and providing some subject matter expertise. Derek is a retired supervisor from the DEA. So he was an agent just like Jason and Wade and Matt Kachansky and I were, but worked for the DEA. At the end of the day, we all have the same job title, same kind of job description. It's just what our focus is. But Derek was an agent in the DEA, went on to be the supervisor in what's known as the Tactical Diversion Squad. He was in New York. Then he went back up to where he's from in Boston, where he is now. So, Derek, I want to turn it over to you so you can give me a little bit of your background. Talk a little bit about traditional DEA work and what you did, and then let's talk a little bit about what is tactical diversion and what does that really mean? Because people, I think, are really kind of up on what is the DEA. They know it as kicking in doors, getting the drugs off the street, and doing that kind of work, but people don't really know what tactical diversion is. So let's talk a little about the two pieces, the DEA and then tactical diversion DEA.
Sure. Well, first off, Eric, thank you so much for having me here. And as you mentioned, I'm crashing the OIG roundtable today. A little bit about me. As Eric mentioned, I retired from the Drug Enforcement Administration approximately 25 years there. I was a special agent, but I retired from the position of supervisory special agent of the Boston Tactical Diversion Squad. And after that, for 2 years, I worked in the Attorney General's Office in Massachusetts, the Medicaid Fraud Division. A lot of folks refer to and know it as the MFUCU. I just never liked that term. It sounds dirty. They refer to it as the Medicaid Fraud Division here in Massachusetts. And then as Eric mentioned, I'm now a consultant for Advise, consulting on healthcare fraud and drug diversion type things. Everyone knows the DEA from the movies that, yes, they kick down the doors, they do narcotic investigations, international money laundering investigations. And I've done a lot of that work, Title III, interphone intercepts. But that's one side of DEA, and that is the majority of the DEA. There's another side of DEA, which is the drug diversion. And specifically, anyone that holds a DEA license to write prescriptions for controlled substances falls under the DEA that we will review them, audit them, and investigate them if they're doing anything that they're not supposed to be doing, any type of illegal practices. And that's where DEA regards it as drug diversion. And some of the illegal practices that drug diversion investigates are pill mills, where a doctor will give you a prescription for anything you want for cash. There's also fake scripts, but we see much, much less of that these days because everything's electronic. Think back, though, when you went to the doctor's office, got a script, a paper script. Anyone with a good computer, a good printer would falsify those, and that's also drug diversion. There's drug pharmacy thefts, whether it's internal, an employee, or external, someone breaks in there, that's drug diversion. But drug diversion is not just drugs. When I say diversion, it can be drugs, but when we're looking at it from a healthcare perspective, it could be DMEs, it could be HIV meds. When we talk diversion, there's two factors that I like to look at. Number one, medical necessity. Is this controlled substance or is this DME or is this HIV med medically necessary? And is that the intended purpose of this item, whether controlled substance or DME? If it's not either one of those, that's a diversion. And how that affects healthcare is that we taxpayers pay for Medicare, Medicaid, or if it's one of the healthcare entities out there, the Blue Cross Blue Shields of the world, they pay for these fees, whether it's through pharmacies or the physicians. And that, of course, is fraud. That is the fraud, waste, and abuse. And I've worked one investigation where it was millions of dollars because of the illegal, medically unnecessary prescriptions that were being written. It adds up quickly.
Yeah, that's a great background. Thanks for throwing that out there. So the one thing that always comes to mind whenever I think of pharmacies and DEA and then the diversion piece, the first thing that always comes to mind is the CDS license, right? The controlled substances license and the ability on the prescriber side to prescribe those drugs, but also on the pharmacy side, right, to dispense. So real briefly, like, let's just talk about that difference, right? So what is the process that a provider needs to go through to get a license, right? Because you see it on your prescriptions. When you go to the doctor and the doctor writes your prescription for whatever it is, there's always their NPI or their state license number. And then there's always that DEA number, which gives them that authority. And then similarly on the pharmacy side, you always see something, hung up on the wall that shows that they have a license to dispense. So let's talk just real briefly, what are the requirements for someone on a provider side to get that license? And then what are the requirements on the pharmacy side?
Well, it always starts with the state. So let's take the provider first. If you're not licensed with your state to be a physician, whether it's a nurse practitioner, whether it's a doctor, anyone that wants to seek a DEA license, if you're not medically licensed by the state, don't bother asking. So it starts there that you have to have a legitimate medical license from the state. Once you have that, you simply apply for a DEA registration, and that would be the DEA license. Registration and DEA license are interchangeable. Once you have that, now you are legally able to write prescriptions for controlled substance. Now let's separate that. There's controlled substances, the schedules 1 through 5, but a physician can write prescriptions for antibiotics or anything that's not a controlled substance without a DEA license. So that's on the provider side. On the pharmacy side, it's the same thing. If you are not licensed by the state to be a pharmacy, then you cannot apply for a DEA license. And some pharmacies don't have a DEA license, but whether it was revoked or they never applied or they're applying for it, they can dispense antibiotics and other types of, other types of chemicals and compounds, if you will. Once you're licensed by the state, again, you will apply to the DEA, an application process, and of course, fees. The government loves their fees, and you will obtain the DEA license. They're, of course, now put you under the scrutiny of the DEA. And that's, again, where tactical diversion and DEA diversion as a whole will start regulating you and auditing you and making sure you're following the rules and regulations, federal rules and regulations, if you will. So it starts with the states. They have to license you first. You have to have the education and the background and the training and all that, and then you will obtain your DEA license.
And I presume that similarly to participation, a requirement of participation in the Medicare Medicaid program, for example, and most other commercial payers, is that you are agreeing that in part of following the rules to be an in-network provider, that you are going to allow for inspections, audits, all of that stuff, right? Like, so at the OIG, if we were going and we wanted to look at records for a provider under the inspection authority under the OIG, you could go in there under, it was federal Title V, you can go in there. We would oftentimes bring a form and that form would outline what the statutory authorities were. We would call it the OI2, which was really just it was like a request for information, but it outlined what the statutory authorities were for the OIG to go there. So if we went to a provider's office and said, hey, we'd like to see the medical record for Jason Eisengrind, and they would say, oh, I'm not giving you that record, it's a HIPAA violation or whatever, we could kind of give them this form. And there was always a fine line, because at the end of the day, if we were doing what was ultimately going to be a criminal investigation, there would be this potential issue of that someone just gave you documents and then self-incriminated. You get to these, these kind of discussions about where that line was about whether you were going to request records or not. But I presume that in the DEA world, that inspection audit authority is similar, right?
Absolutely. So again, when you obtain your DEA license and you apply for that, you agree that you will follow the federal regulations. And part of those federal regulations are that the DEA has the authority to go in and inspect these records. In certain situations, they obviously will give advance notice if it's a routine, and I want to say yearly review, but there's no way the DEA reviews every pharmacy once a year. They just don't have the manpower to do it. So there's the routine type reviews, if you will. And then there's other instances when, and this isn't necessarily targeting a pharmacy, but they may be working a false prescription investigation. They walk into the pharmacy with the DEA authority and say, we need these prescriptions or copies of these right now. And they're able to obtain the original copies and use that criminally. Now, if we're looking at an investigation against the pharmacy or the provider themselves, what you mentioned is very important. If we pick the route that we're going civilly, then there's, you know, you want to use those administrative procedures, if you will, and we can use the DEA authority to look and obtain documents. If you're looking criminally, we would not do that. Now, as a special agent, I did not work the civil side because the version of investigators worked that. However, I supervised the version of investigators, so I'm very familiar with going separate routes here. And specifically, when I either conducted a diversion investigation or I supervised them, I made sure if we're going criminally, we would not use the civil administrative procedures. We would absolutely go in there with a search warrant and seize the documents so that we could use them criminally.
Yeah, and it becomes a fine line, right? A little bit of it is an investigative determination early on, like what you're going to do or what you're not going to do. But so, Jason, I want to go to you because as the I don't know if we'll call you the grand poobah, but as the longest standing member of the community, you started out at the OIG in 1989, and you know were there through a lot of the changes, right? So you were there. You were there before HHS split with Social Security. And so, you know, you worked a variety of cases. And I know, and we talk about this a lot, is that, you know, the OIG was working drug diversion cases before the DEA had tactical drug diversion, right? So, you know, where did you see that intersection where you were working a healthcare fraud case that really had a drug diversion hook? Because there was no one to call on, right? It was the OIG doing these cases.
So despite my youthful appearance, as I like to say, yes, I do offer a historical perspective on things. And I also want to say that just like any fraud or frankly, any criminal or civil fraud violation, it's the tip of the iceberg, right? There's always a lot more below the surface than there is above the surface. So it's not like this just started in 1989 when I entered the picture. What it was is that it was the pre-evolution of a whole situation. So some of the early things were that, number one, Medicaid really was in, you know, those early 90s, let's say, the Medicaid was not on the work plan for OIG for the most part, maybe if there was something really serious, but the you know, routine patrol in Medicaid was not something that was occurring. It was before there was an FDA Office of Criminal Investigation. So FDA was an administrative agency with administrative mission and not equipped to deal with criminal violations. There were even, you know, several other things that just didn't exist at the time. One of them, this not directly related to diversion, but it would fall into the bucket, which were steroids. Steroids were not a controlled substance at the time. And frankly, you know, DEA, they were willing to help out on occasion. And since there was no FDA OCI, it really fell in the lap of HHS OIG. So when that all got started, it was, okay, let's start to look at this. And it became as simple as, let's go out and gather information. And to gather information from witnesses is a standard investigative practice. Well, let's see. So look, there is this white van driven by a person who is taking a group of Medicaid beneficiaries to a doctor for scripts and then onto a pharmacy most times to get the medication. Sometimes not, though. Sometimes they would just leave that pharmacy with a toaster oven or something. I don't know if there were microwaves back then, so I don't think it was a microwave. But anyway, and so it was a revelation to us at OIG anyway, that, wow, this, and Derek mentioned about Mifuku. Mifukus were much more into this early on because it was definitely, it kind of, I think, really raised its ugly head in the Medicaid sector. But so then came on the scene as Part D, like Delta. And now, you know, Medicare was offering coverage for drugs. So it just expanded the problem. So more and more of the iceberg was revealing itself. And the bottom line was that in those early 90s, we flipped a few pharmacists who were, you know, for a lot of different reasons involved in the scheme. And it really opened up to the point where, and again, the FBI didn't have a healthcare squad in those early days. It was the fraud against government squad that kind of captured all of what would happen in fraud against the government. And, you know, so, but as time went on and they had a really great system of healthcare squads, and the DEA expanded its diversion team, it started all coming together. And so in the world of program integrity for Medicare and Medicaid, on the Medicaid side, the UPIC, the Unified Program Integrity Contractor, of which I was the program director for the Western contract for about 4 years, handled the Medicaid side of it. But the Medicare side of it is handled by the IMEDIC, the investigations medic that oversees the Part D. So it's definitely become more focused. There are directed resources now in the area of program integrity, certainly in the area of law enforcement. OI, FBI, and DEA collaborate on strike forces that, you know, have to do with opioids and the drug diversion of those addictive medications, otherwise legitimate. And so, you know, we're definitely in a different place. And, it was interesting to see the development, though, from those early days.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that you brought up, Jason, which is what's going on now, Derek, you know, you're seeing this probably, there's two strike force teams specifically dedicated to opioids, right? You have the Appalachian Regional, which was the first one. And now up in your neck of the woods, the New England Strike Force or Task Force or Strike Force, as they're calling it, for opioids. So there's two of them that are separate and apart from the 14 other strike force areas where they just focus on the opioid issue. And the DEA has a prominent place in both of those task strike forces, as does OIG. You know, Jason brought up the interesting case about the van and the people. You know, I remember that case actually. It was in the Bronx where what was going on was a provider that was in upstate New York would literally have a white van pull up to a low-income building of Medicaid recipients. They would pile into the van. They would drive the van to the doctor's office, who would bill for an office visit that had no medical necessity, write prescriptions to the patients for an opioid that they didn't need or in a lot of cases didn't want. The van would then drive them to the particular pharmacy where either the drugs would be purchased and received, so the pharmacist would make their money off of that. The drugs would be bought back, meaning that the pharmacist would pay the recipient for an amount of, you know, $20, $30 for the script. In other instances, split the drugs with the patient, right? And in other instances, nothing happened and the drugs were just pilfered by the pharmacist from the stock for, you know, whatever they wanted. So there's, you know, that's a real thing. And that's really that intersection between the healthcare fraud, because you got the services that were not rendered, nothing happened, you know, through to diversion. But, you know, as time has gone on with these strike forces now sort of amalgamating people together and the like, you know, that intrinsic involvement of having an agency like the OIG who does healthcare fraud help the DEA understand those kinds of cases and then, you know, vice versa. So Wade, I want to go to you, because when you were in ASAC, you know, one of the things that you had was some agents that were on a DEA task force for diversion. So let's talk a little about what the pros were of that. Like, what were the great benefits of having that sort of co-subject matter expertise?
Well, I think a lot of it, as an ASAC, you look at, you know, investigating resources and looking for your return on those investments. So if I could get two or three agents on a diversion task force, and, you know, so now that those two agents become a team of 10 or 12 agents, you know, you can push those cases through and really get some return on that. So in by return, I mean, you know, criminal complaints, indictments, that type of thing. The only problem with our involvement with the diversion task force was that we had a different mandate. We had to have a Medicare nexus to really participate. And early on, we could say, look, it's early on in the investigation. We're trying to determine if there's a Medicare nexus or a Medicaid nexus. But a lot of times some of the cases would just go down one road that it really just wasn't the nexus. So, you know, sometimes I'd have to pull the agents off, especially if it was for like a big search warrant or something like that, where there was going to be press. Like if our guys are on a search warrant and there's press and our press people see that, you know, they're monitoring the news for OIG activity. And then they find out that our guys are on this search warrant and there's no open Medicare case on it. So then that's a problem. And part of the whole purpose for being on these types of task force or strike forces is, I kind of hated the term they use, but a lot of times they call it a force multiplier. So you invest resources and you have to get something out of it. We also had some really high tech surveillance equipment. We had a van that was decked out with everything you could need, body wires, that type of thing. So that was something else that we were able to bring to the team. DEA had stuff too, but between the combination of the two agencies and some other agencies that participated, that was another kind of investment in the task force that we had. But that was really the kind of the downside, because when you join these teams, you want to be all in, and, you know, you'd work on an investigation for weeks or months, and then there's like a big takedown. And I find out that we haven't been able to find that Medicare nexus. I have to pull my guys off, and they're like teammates. And all of a sudden, you know, the night before a search warrant, they're having to tell the rest of the team, look, my supervisors are pulling me off because we don't have the nexus. So that was really the downside. In most cases, we could find some Medicare nexus, and it didn't have to be complete Medicare case. But if there was a mixture of it, we could then participate, and we were usually able to find that. But there were a couple instances where we weren't, and it was a little bit of clashing between the members, because they wanted our guys out there, and I had to say, look, we can't do it. So that was really the downside.
Yeah, and that is a challenge. So for the people that watch our podcast, you know, one of the things that people always need to keep in mind is that agencies have a mandate, right? They have a mission, and you stay within that mission, right? The OIG's mission, all OIG's missions are prevention, detection of fraud, waste, and abuse within its programs. And HHS, very specifically, you have to have a Medicare or a Medicaid nexus to a case. And, you know, really, Wade, what you're really talking about is, from an agent's perspective, that frustration of going down this path of working on this case, and then you find out, hey, there's really no Medicare or Medicaid nexus to it, and then you've got to pull out. And so that inherently creates a little bit of an animosity, right? Because now I've been partnered with an agency, you know, I'm doing something with tactical diversion, and you're working, and you've been this great partner, and then all of a sudden the rug gets pulled out from you.
Yeah.
And that is a challenge. And I think, you know, one of the things that's going on in today's climate is, I think there's a little bit more of that level setting, that there is, you know, when you've got an agency like the OIG being very intrinsically involved in the opioid task forces, there has to be an understanding that not every case is going to have Medicare or Medicaid, that these are more global healthcare fraud issues. And it's really gotten to, you know, and I've spoken to some people around the country where it's like, is this provider a Medicare, Medicaid participating provider? Because is there a potential harm in the global sense that if they're working this pill mill here, you know, what sort of outlying issues are there as the person as a participating provider in the Medicaid, Medicare program? So, you know, I think that the OIG has taken a little bit of a recalibration on those things as time has gone on. Jason, I'm gonna turn it back over to you for a second. Go ahead.
So a couple of things. And this particular vulnerability area is near and dear to my heart. So I'm trying not to go down that long nostalgic road, but nonetheless, I really appreciated what we talked about with the return on investment, because after all, what we're all doing, people that are tuning into these podcasts, what we're doing is we're running a business. And, you know, we have to recognize, okay, what do we do to get this job done? And it became, back in those early 90s, interesting. Like, so from a business point of view, are you going to rent or buy in your business model? So in this case, renting or buying the resources that were needed. So do you just, you know, get involved and ask the DEA or, you know, whatever other agency, the Mofuku, to help out? So what we did is we started harvesting talent from these other organizations. So the current, I would say one of the newest assistant inspectors general at OIG, hired from the New York State Mofuku. The current SAC in the headquarters environment hired from DEA as a diversion investigator there. The current deputy inspector general was new talent at the time and, you know, had a significant interest in exploring the new avenues, or what I like to call the back streets of HHS. And so it just really became a conglomeration of talent that we were able to harvest from the different organizations. And then just one other thing, and I don't mean to make levity of it, but I'll just use it as an opportunity. So all that investigating and routine medical patrol in the borough of the Bronx, you need to, you know, agents and officers need to have nutrition. So the debriefing on Arthur Avenue afterwards, where you could get enough carbohydrates for a month, forgetting about a day, was always worth the time spent up there.
Thank you for referencing one by saying the back streets of HHS. So thank you for the Bruce Springsteen reference for the back streets, but then also for Arthur Avenue and its Italian food. I appreciate that. So Derek, I wanna close out because we're getting ready to run out of time. But you know, one of the things that I think is important is, you know, so when I was in New Jersey as an OIG agent, one of the last cases I worked on was a doctor with a pill mill. It was a DEA tactical diversion case. We got invited in to assist. And one of the great values that we brought to that case was the fact that the DEA tactical diversion investigators and agents, they had never done a search warrant in a doctor's office before and really ostensibly had no idea what they were coming up against. They had three people from DC, and I was just telling you the story. They had three people from their evidence team from DC come up with laptops and scanners with the intention of scanning every medical record that was in the provider's office, which is an impossibility. I mean, you know, portable scanners, you can't do it. So, you know, one of the things that we helped to bring to the table was that kind of logistics understanding of you don't take everything, you know, you do that. I want to give you the last little piece of this because, you know, one of the things that was interesting is, you know, you took an interest in the healthcare fraud side, you know, to learn about CPT codes and HCPCS codes and the things that kind of bring those two pieces together. What's your biggest takeaway on the value that comes from these cross-agency partnerships on something where you're doing an investigation on a pill mill doctor?
Well, the thing that I love to do was to work with the FBI, the healthcare fraud, HHS, OIG, FDA, the Mofuku's Medicaid Fraud Division of the World. And the reason was is you learn something, and that's how I learned services not rendered and these types of things. And why it was important was to take a step back. When DEA diversion was started, a tactical diversion, we were looking at bringing criminal cases to prosecutors, whether it be the U.S. Attorney's Office or even state prosecutors, it was difficult initially to get them to accept these cases. And even to this day, and I'm not going to speak for all the prosecutorial offices, but the ones I've worked with in New York and Massachusetts, this is not a knock on them, they only prosecute Schedule 2 narcotics. So if we were looking at Schedule 3, 4, and 5, they would not prosecute that federally. Some of the states wouldn't even look at that. What it meant to work with HHS, FBI, FDA was, okay, I'm not going to end this investigation and let, I don't want to say a criminal go because everyone's innocent until proven guilty, but let's get something out of this. Getting back to what Jason and Wade were saying, bang for your buck. We are in a business of, the business of the DEA is we put criminals in jail. Now, they may not be the worst criminals of the world, but some of these doctors are. If I can't get that individual on criminal narcotic, federal narcotic charges, can we get them in a healthcare fraud? What do you need? Oh, and this is how you'll learn. Okay, what we need for healthcare fraud is this. What we need for something else, FDA charges, is this. And actually, I did the bath salt task force in New York City in 2012, when we went after bath salts. They were over, it was an epidemic taking over the United States. And in that first federal prosecution, we actually charged them with FDA Title 42. We did not go with Title 21 DEA. That's the benefit of working together. And I get it, as Wade mentioned, that there could be some drawbacks. I think as a whole, all the federal agencies are not looking at that anymore. At the beginning, that was the case. But when we work together, there's a sharing information. There's the knowledge of learning how to do things. And if I can't get someone on Title 21 federal narcotics violations, maybe we can get them on something else.
Yeah, that's a great point. And, you know, I remember the task force in New York, the El Dorado task force, was a pretty prominent task force that included IRS, HHS, FBI, it included everyone. And that's a great point, is that when you are working on these cases, you know, the DEA is a Title 21 agency, right? The IRS is Title 26. HHS is Title 18, Title 42. When you start bringing in these agencies that have the ability to do the prosecution of those violations, you certainly, you know, open that up. But, you know, it is a conversation we can continue to have on that importance. And I'll tell you, you know, look, we here, you know, we've talked about this here at Advise. We're doing a number of projects. I'm working on a number of projects on the legal side with pharmacies and some potential diversion issues and CDS issues. And, you know, that expertise that we bring as a company is one thing, but you bring a piece of that puzzle that, you know, that understanding, one, number one, when those suspensions are prepared and they're given to a pharmacy, you know, you prepared them. So you have the inside information on what is needed, what's not needed, how to get yourself out of the pickle, because the point of a suspension is what can you do to rectify it, unless you've got some additional plus issue. But, you know, how do you fix your problem, right? How do you get off of punishment? It's a little bit like on the traditional, on the UPIC side, right? On a prepay, how do you get out of prepay? If you're in a suspension status, how do you get unsuspended, right? So, you know, people like Jason and Matt Kachansky, they understand that process, that fix it. You know, from your perspective, it's fixing the problem, right? And I think that becomes a piece of the puzzle that a lot of people on the outside don't fully understand that we bring. And I know I've spoken to you on a couple of projects on that. And it's been, you know, it's been a little bit of an education for me about, you know, how that process works. So, Jason, go ahead.
Yeah, just one quick point. Going back to the rent or buy decision. So, Derek is doing, he's as an advised resource, he is assigned to a contract we have with an SIU. So, you know, if you don't, and I'm hearing this more and more as feedback to these podcasts and a couple of presentation venues that we've been at, is that it's an interesting concept where you may not be able to justify, hey, we need a whole resource that can deal with a particular subject matter area. It might be more beneficial from a cost analysis for an entity like an SIU, for instance, to rent the resource from a place like Advise. And I'm sure there are other places that have fine resources as well. I just know that, yeah, the resources here are top notch because they have street credibility, and it's not like this was studied in a book. It was done in the field. So it's field tested.
Yeah, I mean, that rent to buy thing really does, rent or own really does permeate across a lot of sectors, right? Because, you know, when you're on these task forces, maybe the case doesn't involve an HHS person to be part of it. Maybe the case doesn't need a DEA person, but it needs an HHS person. So you're really kind of that plug and play is what part of that is. So look, we're out of time. It's been great. Jason, Wade, always great to have you. Derek, this was great information. I think we're going to have to do another one. I really need to spend some time where we just really talk about suspensions and revocations in, you know, in that space, which I think is a big piece. I'm seeing a lot of these projects coming our way. I think currently there are two or three projects that we're working here at Advise specifically relative to DEA licensure with CDS on the pharmacy side, with some inventory discrepancies and things of the like. So these are great conversations to have. So thanks everybody for tuning in. Really appreciate it. If you're not getting our newsletter, I do encourage you to sign up for it. Our podcasts are deployed every Friday as part of our newsletter. You can send an email to hello@advize.com. We'll get you signed up for that newsletter where every week we put out some content along those lines. For those of you that follow our LinkedIn, we've got our next LinkedIn Live is going to be, I believe it's April 14th. Jason and Matt are going to be doing an amazing LinkedIn Live where they're going to be talking about CMS-related, UPIC-related suspensions and revocations is going to be the topic. For those of you that are seeing a lot of this in the press, there's a fairly large number of suspensions, revocations going on. The big catchphrase out there is credible allegation of fraud. So Jason and Matt are going to spend some time on April 14th or April 11th, I think, at a LinkedIn Live where they're going to be talking about this from the UPIC perspective. So a lot of content out there. If you are, if you miss one of our recordings, you can always catch it on Spotify. You can also catch it on YouTube. We have a YouTube channel. Just go up to YouTube and type in Advise Health. You'll find our channel, all of our OIG roundtables, the retro frauds, our LinkedIn Lives, all that content is there. So thanks very much to everybody, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you.
Thank you.